So at the break, we'll do the paper exchanges. The way to do it is everybody bring up your papers here and put them in three piles. One pile is mine. And then I will, when we reconvene, we'll just randomly send around the other two piles and everybody gets two. Did anybody not bring three copies? It does sometimes happen. So this class has the distinction. I would say I probably taught this class, you know, in its iterated versions 20 times, I suppose. Probably more, probably 30 times, 25 times. I think this is the first time that everybody has come with three papers. The routine is you just put in a blank sheet with your name on it. Because if we don't distribute them all together, then there's orphan papers later. Okay, so we'll do that during the break. Now, what I think is best is for you to write your comments. If you want a digital copy of one of the papers that you're reading, because sometimes it's convenient to have it, if you're now used to reading and commenting on digital materials, then you contact your classmate to get the digital copy. But still write out your comments. And I need a copy of everybody's comments so that I can have it as a record. The comments on the two papers that you're reading are due in class a week from today. And I will do my absolute best to also have my comments on all of your papers done by a week for today because of my having snipped out of my available time to stay on top of things 4 days from my trip. I don't think I can make a signed in blood promise to get them all done by this time next week, but I really will work hard to do so. It's best for me as well to kind of get closure on this. And I want to give all of you time to be able to revise your papers if you want to. As I was explaining to a student in the class, it's often necessary to write a paper before you can write a paper. And I'm sure many of you have had that experience, if not for this paper, for other papers. And if you write the paper too close to a deadline so you don't have time to write it after you've written it, then doing it after you get comments is a good way to go. Okay, we are now...
real quick question.
Yeah.
Can we submit the comments to you digitally? Can I mark this up, scan it, and send it to you just to keep printing down?
What I would prefer my copy to be printed, but if you write comments in the paper, really the best thing for me is for you to extract the comments as a consolidated.
Oh, okay. Submit a sheet to you.
A sheet with them on, rather than
marginal.
Rather than marginal comments. Yeah, it's fine for you in writing comments for your fellow students to do it in the form of a comment function. My personal experience, just as a professor writing comments on papers, is that I often write comments in that form as I read the paper. But then when I'm done, I write consolidated comments, because I think it's sometimes better for the person getting the comments to not have them all in the form of the little snippets, commenting on a particular point. That's valuable as well. But to kind of consolidate, okay, here's the bottom line. Here are the four things that I think need some more thinking, or which my comments are not going to be, by the way, just to know, and this can also guide your commenting. Comments are not the same as just writing criticisms. A lot of my comments have the form, that's a really interesting point. It made me think of this. Or another way you might explore this is, which isn't saying, you should have done it that way. Sometimes it is. Sometimes the implicit statement is, this is a bit jumbled. An alternative, better way of doing it is, right? But no, really, I try very hard to read papers not from what I would call a flaw-centered perspective. You know, my task is to find everything wrong in what you did. My task is to help you figure out what's most interesting in what you did. And sometimes you've already figured that out, what's most interesting, and when that's the case, then I just respond. So I treat writing comments more like a conversation with the paper. And of course it varies. Sometimes a paper that I get really needs reconstruction, and my task then is to be a kind of mentor editor with respect to it. And other times it's just fun to talk to you about it, which I then do in the form of comments. And you should also try to get into that mindset. It also, if you're going to do this for a long time, you know, I've been doing this in Wisconsin for 37 years now, so if you're going to do this for a long time, that's the stance you have to take in order for it not to be a perpetual burden. So getting 15 papers, a lot of my colleagues find, oh God, I got, you know, this is the worst task, I got to read 15 papers. Whereas I say, oh, this is great, now I have to carve out the time to engage other people's minds and ideas. And then every once in a while, it's all gone. I don't want to make this a kind of romantic fantasy of intellectual journeys. It's both, but try to treat the commenting as a intellectually engaging task. But as you do too, just remember that I'll be doing 15 or 16 of these. So this is my giving you the assignment is also a way to enhance your appreciation for the time and effort it takes. Enough of this bantering. On to new problems. So we're doing a block here, which is a kind of bridge between the account of class structure and then the next two major pieces of the course on the state and on ideology. This is a kind of bridge. We're discussing here the problem of class formation, and the problem of the state and ideology also bear very heavily on the problem of class formation. So that's why this is a kind of bridging concept, bridging section. The term class formation itself does not have a standardized use in the literature. Sometimes the term class formation is used to mean the formation of class structures, the formation, development, and evolution of the structural positions of structural nature of class itself. It's the formation of a class system. That's not the way I'm using it. I use it as a counterpoint to class structure. So it's a kind of couplet, class structure and class formation. Class structures define the locations of people within a structure of social relations. Class formations describe the way in which the people who are already located within class structures get reorganized into collectivities. So one way of thinking about it is that class structures define the vertical relations among people within systems of exploitation and domination, whereas class formations define the horizontal relations among people within systems of domination and exploitation. Sometimes people think, incorrectly, that the study of class structures strictly revolve around positions, locations, whereas the study of class formation and class struggle centers on people, the actual practices of real people confronting the world. Sometimes people think that this structure formation contrast is a distinction between structures and people, or structures and agency. That's really not the way to think about this either. Both analyses revolve around people. That is, a structural analysis is not an analysis of something other than people. It is an analysis of people. Both the analysis of class structure and class formation are analyses of people, but it's an analysis of people viewed from different vantage points. The analysis of class structures views individuals as incumbents of relationally defined positions. The analysis of class formation reviews individuals as participants in collective actions. Incumbents, a person can be an incumbent of a location, or a person can be enmeshed in a structure of relations engaged in collective action. One of the central objectives of class analysis then, and you know, some people really place this at the very center of class analysis, is to understand how individuals as incumbents of positions become organized, disorganized, and reorganized into individuals as participants in struggle. And that's one way to think about it. Individuals as incumbents of positions, on the one hand, individuals as participants in struggles, on the other, and between those two is a process through which they become organized, disorganized, and reorganized. And that intermediate thing is the problem of class formation. How do people as incumbents of positions become collectively organized, disorganized, and reorganized, and disorganized, and organized? You know, it's an endless, messy, not cycle, but overlapping set of processes into their lives as individuals and participants in struggles. And that's the process of class formation, that phenomenon. Okay, that's point one, structures and people. A broad way of thinking about this whole problem is that is to begin by revisiting class structure itself, because class structure defines the terrain on which class formations occur, to revisit the concept of class structure, and to see it as defining three different kinds of people. And we have sort of little labels for these. Every person in a class structure, when looking at all the other people in that class structure, can identify three different sorts of folks out there in the class structure. And you can think of it this way. They're your potential friends, there's your potential enemies, and there's your potential allies. So one way of thinking about class formations are a way of finding your friends, identifying your enemies, and figuring out how to form coalitions with your allies. And that's what class formations do. Class formations are formations of friends, formations of enemies, and then formations of these coalitions of allies. Friends, enemies, and allies. It's a little glib. You know, that's one of these ways of distilling a set of problems. The Haven Center, the next time you're in the Haven Center, if you haven't been there already, in the seminar room, there's a poster which says, class consciousness is knowing what side of the fence you are on. Class analysis is knowing who's there with you. And that's a kind of interesting point. That is, it's easy, relatively spontaneously, in your lived experience within a class structure, you know who's opposed to you. That's, you know, what side of the fence, the big fence you're on. But you are often mistaken about who else is there with you. That requires analysis. That requires really understanding the inner workings of things. Now, if you recall from the analysis of class structure itself, I argued that one way of thinking about what class structures do to people is to think of class structures as defining a set of interests which people have and a set of lived experiences that people have. This is, I think, the way to think about how class structure bears on the problem of class formation. Class structure bears on the problem of how classes get formed collectively as actors by defining a terrain of material interests that people have, but also a kind of terrain of lived experiences that people have. And that combination of interests and experiences is what gets drawn upon in the formation of collective actors. And that expression, drawn upon, I think the way to think about it is this. And so this, again, I'll give you a slightly mechanical view of it, but to illustrate the point. Just imagine you're an activist. You want to form people into collective actors. And you're approaching a terrain of people who are embedded in social relations. And what are you going to do to get them to agree to join a labor union, a social movement, a political party, all the kind of collective organizations that constitute the basis for collective action? What do you appeal to? You appeal to their interests. Given where you are in the class structure, this kind of organization is going to help you with respect to your interests. And you draw on their identities. This is the kind of person you are. But identities are deeply connected, not just to interests, although they bear on it, but also to the life experience you have, what happens to you by virtue of being in a class structure. So a nice way of kind of thinking about this is to do it from the point of view of an activist trying to mobilize people. Right? If you think of it from that perspective, and you think of the obstacles you encounter, and some obstacles are such that you have to say, yes, I know this isn't entirely in your interests, but you have overlapping interests, and we can find common ground. Right? So that's the allies' problem. So the way to, again, to think about it is with respect to interests, the friends, enemies, allies contrast. There are people who share the same basic interests. There are people who have antagonistic material interests. And there are people whose interests aren't identical, but may be sufficiently overlapping to form coalitions. The idea of contradictory class locations, that was a way of theorizing the nature of the interest space in a class structure. The interest space, the way interests get distributed across persons by virtue of class structures. The idea of contradictory class locations was a way of giving precision to the notion that not everybody is going to actually share the same material interests, but they may have overlapping interests. Skilled workers don't share all the same interests of unskilled workers. Credentialed workers who have protected jobs don't share. And if you say they do, and if your approach as an activist is to say, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, and you're talking to an x-ray technician who has a secure job in a well-funded hospital, and they think, I have something to lose other than my chains, you're not addressing the specificity of their interests in the class structure. You might be able to convince them, you know, in the context of globalization and neoliberalism, although you do have a secure job, you are embedded in a structure of relations where it's constantly under threat and in which other people who you have connections to, blah, et cetera, et cetera. That's what the concept of, what an elaborated concept of class structure helps you to develop sophistication about, the terrain of interests not being so simple. But in addition to the shared interest, antagonistic interests, and overlapping interests, there's also in a sense, a trilogy of lived experiences in a class structure. So again, you can define three sorts of people. People who share the same basic array of class life experiences, class-based life experiences. People who have completely different kinds of class-based life experiences, and people with overlapping experiences. One way of thinking about these two dimensions is that class interests are particularly important for the cognitive conditions for class formation, whereas lived experiences are particularly important for the affective or emotional conditions of class formation. Or to say it again slightly differently, the lived experiences bears especially on the salience of identity, which has much more of a affective or emotional content to them. We will, to anticipate a later part of the course when we discuss ideology, interests and experiences are raw materials that get transformed into subjectivity. So interests and lived experiences are the raw materials of life that get transformed into subjectivity of actors through what we will call, in the last part of the course, ideological practices. That's what the work of doing ideology in the world means. Helping people understand or confusing them about, depending upon the nature of your ideological practices, understand their interests and interpret their lived experiences. And doing that work of cognitively getting people to understand and develop their beliefs around the nature of their interests and the interpretations of their lived experiences are what produces the forms of subjectivity that then animate collective action. And you can never take that transition for granted. You know, it's a black box, it happens inside the minds of people, but it takes work, and the kind of work it takes to produce those subjectivity, that's the subject of ideology. All right, so let's move on to the interest logic of class formation. The interest logic of class formation has a much more straightforward and systematic character than the experience logic of class formation. This is getting into what might be thought of as epistemologically dense terrain. The translation, the problem around interests is largely a question of getting people to properly understand the nature of the world in which they live. So people make cognitive mistakes. They misunderstand their interests. And therefore, there is a real sense in which you can say somebody has false consciousness about their interests. That is, they've just made mistakes. They think that the source of their difficulties in life, the reason why they can't support their family, is because they're failures, as opposed to because they're being treated badly. So people can be wrong about their interests. I think that's a reasonable way of describing a situation. So that the task around interests is more straightforward. It's correcting mistakes. The tasks around lived experience, providing people with alternative interpretations of their lived experiences, that's tougher. That's not so simple. It's not so clear what the correct versus false, in quotes, interpretation of how you experience your life is. It's a more complicated matter. And that's why discussions of class formation tend to be more systematic and rigorous around the connection between interests and formation than around the connection between experience and formation. There's much more ambiguity in that latter connection. And that's, again, an issue which we'll be exploring at various times. But let's begin with the simpler thing. Let me just make a little side comment here as well. The expression, let's begin with the simpler problem, you know, that often leads people astray because many people have a resistance to the idea that it makes sense to begin with the simplest issues, to try to get as rigorous an understanding of them as possible, and then to add the more difficult and ambiguous and complex matters. They think that by starting with the simplest ones, one is also announcing that they're the most important. And that's just a mistake. It's just a mistake. This is a common mistake that's made with respect to the criticism of rational choice theory and game theory. We'll discuss that a little bit in the class formation discussion. Game theory is a particular way of understanding how people strategically interact in contexts of conflict, where people's ability to achieve certain things depends upon the strategies of other people, right? So game theory is a way of talking about those contexts, and rational choice theory is a particular way of developing game theory. What a rational choice model says is, let's begin with the really simplest problems, which turn out to be really tough anyway, assuming people are rational, that they really know what they're doing, and assuming that their interests are simple. They're interested in their own well-being. So let's just assume that, and then let's try to understand how action takes place. Starting with that simple thing is not the same as saying, and in the world, the most important forces in play are rational, selfish action. There is no claim that in the world those are the most important. What is being claimed is that for developing our insights, that's the best place to begin, because we can get a lot of clarity about that part of the problem, and then we can add in a more systematic way the complexity. Whereas if you begin with a fully rounded human personality engaged in social action, with all of their irrationalities and moral commitments and passions, and you start with that complexity, then you end up, I think, only being able to describe what happens rather than to really develop explanations. Okay, so we're beginning with a simple point of departure, but it is a point of departure. In many analyses, the point of departure also ends up being the point of conclusion. People don't get beyond the simple starting point. I don't think that should necessarily be viewed as something to criticize, because sometimes that's so hard, the point of departure is so hard, that it's an accomplishment to successfully depart and to have clarity at that point. What's a mistake is if the person then also makes the claim, if a paper also makes the claim, and this is a full account of the processes involved. Now that's the sin of a lot of economists. The sin is that they take the point of departure, work incredibly rigorously in demanding ways on that point of departure, and then make the false claim that it's the comprehensive account of how the world works. And they therefore make the mistake of being seduced by the complexity of their simple models into thinking that therefore it matches the complexity of the world. But that's, it's a big mistake. It causes lots of problems in social science. But it's also a kind of small mistake. It's an easily correctable mistake. You know, it's a mistake in the opening to the conclusion of a paper. The first paragraph should say, okay, here's how to summarize the central findings from this simple point of departure, so to speak. That corrects the mistake. But now let's get on to the core logic of interest logic. Okay, in a simple polarized conception of the class structure, just to remind you, there are two basic kinds of interest formation processes. There are the interests of the oppressed or the exploited in collectively organizing, people who are harmed by the existing structures of domination and exploitation have interests in organizing collectively. Basically, the thesis is something like this: all things being equal, an oppressed group will tend to organize for collective resistance to its oppression. This is a broad, kind of universal thesis. I'm prepared to say that it's a human universal, that where people's interests are harmed by an existing structure, there will be a tendency for them to resist. That's a kind of broad claim about the interests of the subordinate, oppressed, dominated. You know, you can use different terms depending upon the context. And the complementary term, the complementary idea for the interests of the oppressor or exploiter or dominator, depends again about the context, is the interests of the oppressor is in preventing the collective organization of the oppressed. The core thesis goes something like this: the more the interests of oppressors are threatened by challenges, the more they will attempt to repress collective organization of the oppressed, to repress the organization of the oppressed. And so this generates two foundational causal relations. The interests of the exploited classes is oppositional class formations of one sort or another. The interests of dominant or exploiting classes is repressive class formation. We can define oppositional class formation as collective organization to realize interests against domination, and we can define repressive class formations as fundamentally reactive to prevent such resistance. In this sense, the class formation of dominant classes is a response to the resistance of subordinate classes. Ruling classes would not need to form coalitions, to form collective organizations to defend their interests, except for the fact that they get resistance. So, you know, again, these are very abstract kind of claims. The initiators of class struggle are actually the exploited. The ruling classes would not need to organize states. They would not need for this purpose. They'd have other reasons why they might want states to coordinate some of their own problems that they face as ruling classes. But they need collective organization to defend themselves, given that their structural position triggers collective resistance. If it didn't, if there was no triggering of collective resistance on the part of subordinate classes, then ruling classes wouldn't need to form collective organizations to advance their interests. The structure itself advances their interests. Their interests are embedded in the dominant class structure. It's by virtue of the fact that that triggers resistance that they have to themselves then get their act together to collectively respond to that resistance. These aspects are, in a way, pretty transparent. No one really doubts that the interests and repressions shape profoundly collective action. This then leads to a map of interests in the class structure as generating a map of potential class formations. And these potential class formations, in turn, help explain potentials for struggle. And this I summarize in this little picture. This kind of picture we will encounter repeatedly from here on out. The way to read this little diagram is to make a distinction between two kinds of explanatory connections between concepts. One, the dashed line, dashed and solid don't mean more, less or more important. They're just ways of, if I could have color-coded these, it would have been cuter. But the dotted line is a relationship of structural limitation. It says that one kind of structure imposes limits on another. And the solid line is a line of transformation. Transformation always goes between a set of practices, activities that people engage in this case, struggles. It always goes between practices and structures. And the relation of limitation always goes between one structure and another, or between structures and practices. Now, that's super abstract. This is kind of meta theory at its worst or best, depending upon your view of it. There's this old, simple idea. It's captured in virtually all social theories one way or another. Marx has the famous statement, to slightly edit it, people make history, but not just as they choose. The people make history bit in that expression is people through their actions transform the world. The not just as they choose bit says the world as it is puts constraints on how people make history. The puts constraints on how people make history is the notion of limits. The people make history is the notion of transformation. So practices transform structures. Structures impose limits on practices. And that's reflected in this little diagram with these kinds of arrows. That's the basic kind of terminological convention that I use in discussing all of the themes around class, state, and ideology. Structures impose limits on practices, practices transform structures, but transform structures within limits that are determined by the structures themselves. Now I'll just add one other point here, a little point of additional sophistication, which we will return to, so you don't have to, don't worry if you don't fully understand this additional point. So I'll repeat the prior statement. Structures impose limits on practices. Practices transform structures, but under limits set by the structures themselves. If those limits were always finely tuned and functional, so that practices only transform structures to the extent that those transformations help to reinforce the structures themselves, that is, if the limits that govern the relationship between structures and practices were always functional limits, then you'd be in an iron cage and you could never change the world. A key idea that we will be returning to, particularly when we get to the state and ideology and then the payoff, transformation of capitalism at the end of the semester, the key idea is that these structural limits turn out to contradict each other in all sorts of ways. They don't create a seamless functioning system. The limits create, they're contradictory limits. They're limits that violate each other so that there's space for practices which are actually disruptive. Don't worry about all of that. That's some foreshadowing ideas that we will be exploring later. Okay, that's let's take this simple interest-based model. Class structures impose limits on both class formations and class struggles. The kind of class formations you get depend upon the class structures. The range of class formations you can get, that's the way to put it, depend upon the class structures you have, and the kinds of struggles that you can engage in depend upon the existing class structures and class formations. But within all of those limits, class struggles transform both class structures and class formations. That's what this little picture says. Let's take that as our core beginning model. The next question then is this: why interests alone cannot explain class formations? If simply knowing these potentials, this underlying structural relation, class structures impose limits on class formations, was sufficient to predict actual struggles, then the analysis of class formation would be pretty simple. But this is not, in fact, the case. All that we have indicated is that class structures impose limits on class struggles. That is, it makes some more likely than others, but it does not determine specific class formations or specific class struggles. And here's the key point. An analysis of interests, no matter how refined it is never adequate to explain struggles. Never. There is no instance in which knowing the interests of actors is sufficient to explain how they act, sufficient to explain the actual confrontations of actions, the confrontations being what we call class struggles. There are a number of reasons why interests alone are never sufficient to explain struggles. And what's listed under Roman numeral 2 here are 6 different reasons why interests by themselves cannot explain struggles. Let me just very briefly explain what each of these are, but I won't belabor this point. I think the point may be pretty obvious once stated, but it's a point that's often forgotten. And this point, by the way, applies both to the practices of ruling classes as well as subordinate classes. The interests of capitalists are never sufficient to explain their practices, their struggles. even when their struggles correspond closely to their interests, it still is not a sufficient explanation, because it may be a puzzle. Why do they act in their interests when there's all sorts of reasons why they might not? So it still is never the case that interests alone are sufficient to explain practices. So there are four issues. First, consciousness. Actors may not have clear understandings of their interests. They may be confused. So at a minimum, you have to explain why they're not confused. If people are acting in a way that's in sharp correspondence to their interests, you have to explain how come they've managed to figure out what their interests are. Secondly, as I've been emphasizing, lots of social positions involve contradictory interests. And if you have contradictory interests, there is no simple translation of your interests into your practices. You have to figure out how to weight them, which to give priority to. And that's particularly true for understanding the problem of class alliances. Class alliances, the very idea of class alliances, implies ambiguity and indeterminacy, because there are many possible alliances that could be forged depending upon how people weigh the different parts of their interests. Thirdly, even more densely, interests are not one-dimensional. People have many different kinds of interests, not just class interests. People can have occupational interests, national interests, ethnically based interests. They can even have legitimately what could be called spiritual interests. And their spiritual interests may contradict their material interests. Someone who, in terms of their deep sense of meaning in the world and their subjective weighing of how the meanings that they find, the ultimate meanings that they find in a spiritual way, fit with their material interests, may reject their material interests altogether. When people choose an ascetic way of life in the quest for some kind of spiritual wholeness, it doesn't make sense to say they're acting against their material interests and have false consciousness. It's just a wrong-headed way of thinking about it. They've rejected their material interests as a basis for action. They can have a perfectly clear-headed view that, yes, this is not the way to maximize my material standard of living or my material interest, but I don't care. That's not the interest that I'm acting on. That's not false consciousness. That's clear-headed understanding of what they're giving up in order to pursue their spiritual interest. Now, if they thought, living an ascetic life was the way to get rich because God would shower you with gold at the end of the process, that would be false consciousness. That would be an incorrect understanding about how the world works. The world does not bestow great wealth on people who withdraw from the world into a life of contemplation, except under very weird contingent circumstances. So that would be false consciousness. If a person actually believed that the path to wealth was a life of austere, ascetic withdrawal from the world. But that's not how people who make such choices understand the world. They understand that they're giving up, relinquishing particular kinds of interests. And that's one reason why you can't predict from their material interests what people would do. Again, this is an extreme case of spiritual interests versus material interests. Fourth, lived experiences. Even apart from the complexity of the array of interests, contradictory interests, etc., the lived experiences of people differ enormously within any given set of interests. Different things happen to people. Motivations to act are shaped both by reason and emotion, and these can operate at cross purposes. One way of thinking about this is one of the lived experiences of class relations is humiliation within work. But not all workplaces humiliate workers to the same degree, and some workplaces enable people to live dignified lives within work. The supervisors are respectful, they value a kind of the value of the dignity of work, and they reinforce that it's not the case that all workplaces are constant assaults on a person's sense of self. You know, they're not all deeply humiliating. That varies a lot, and that produces very different lived experiences, and that bears on how people's identities and thus how their interests get translated into action. Fifth, collective action dilemmas. This is something we'll be exploring in the next lecture. Even if everybody has clear-headed understanding of their interests, even if there's no cross-cutting identities, you know, even if it's all straightforward and simple, so we've really radically shed the complexity, even under those conditions, you can't predict how interests play out in collective action and struggles because of what are called collective action dilemmas. And finally, there's the problem of class power, not just interests. Participation in struggles always at least partially depends upon the predicted outcome of struggle. And those outcomes can depend upon the relative power of contending forces. And many factors affect power besides just interests. The degree of solidarity, for example, is a key problem. If you are in a class struggle where you know that there's going to be, that there's problems of solidarity, that under duress and under, you know, sharp reaction from authorities, the solidarity which seems strong is going to crumble. And you have that insight into the nature of your collective organization. That insight is a claim about how much power you actually have. And you may be, you know you're bluffing. You know, you have a big mass rally and everybody is sounding militant, but you know actually it's paper thin. And that under any kind of police repressive response, it's going to crumble. Well, that may affect your willingness to even engage in the struggle, knowing that it doesn't take much for it to fall apart. So all of these reasons come into play in what I think is the fundamental way to think about the connection between class structures and class formation and class struggle on this interest terrain, this first simple model, which is that class structures define a terrain of obstacles and opportunities for potential class formations, but class structures do not determine by themselves a specific class formation. Think of class structures as defining a terrain of obstacles and opportunities. And these obstacles and opportunities get generated by the especially by this interest space, the way interests get arrayed and organized in a class structure. But we need a lot of additional ideas and mechanisms and arguments in order to understand how actual class formations get constructed on that terrain. All right. Roman numeral 3, a general approach to the micro foundations of class formation. This is basically going to be a kind of introduction to the relevance of game theory as a way of framing the problem of how to build collective organizations on a terrain of class structure for purposes of engaging in collective action. Game theory as the broad structural framework for approaching this problem, which then gets combined with all sorts of other things when you actually produce real explanations. So I guess what I would suggest is that we take our break now. Try to reconvene as close to 5 after as we can. Well, let's say 10 after because we're going to do the paper distribution. Then I will briefly go through these points. I think that'll take about 15 minutes, and then we'll have half hour, 35 minutes for discussion. Okay? So let's create 3 piles of papers here. So you everybody walk around twice. Create the three piles, and then the second time. And after you've all put it down, what you should do is take two papers from one pile, because that way you'll be guaranteed of taking two different papers. Yeah.
We're stalling to create a...
Well, or you can just come back. Once we've got the three piles, you can at any time...
Oh, okay.
Since I want this to be randomized rather than you sorting through to find a particular paper, it'll be all luck of the...
I've got some folders here.
Put them in the way they are now, and then you'll switch them, because people are going to start picking.
Oh, okay.
So just... Yeah, so just put them there, and Fei Yang is going to, whoever gets Fei Yang's paper, she's going to go and reprint them because there's a big formatting mistake. Okay, has everybody deposited your papers? All right, now you can come and take two from one pile. Just come around, grab two, don't worry about it. But take them both from one pile.
Sorry.
Take them both from the same pile.
Oh, same pile. All right.
I mean, it's just... Of course, if there's an odd number, somebody's going to have to take one from two piles, but...